The Nature Stories podcast, where people and place intersect.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Walden University Graduate Degrees Online, working to help students achieve their vision of success. Walden University, waldenu.edu.
His neck slung with binoculars, Baldwin said the fact that a red-tailed hawk was thriving on Fifth Avenue revealed a side of the city he'd rarely thought about.
This isn't just a man-made location. This isn't just a world of media and personalities. You know, there's a whole other order of life that's invisible, you know, except when something remarkable like this happens.
You're listening to the Nature Stories podcast. I'm Samantha Brown. Each week, we bring you pieces about the intersection between people and place. This week, why species like hawks and herons are moving back to cities like New York, and what happens when they do. This podcast is curated by Atlantic Public Media in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. Up now, Wildlife Returns to the City, the first piece in a three-part series produced by Kristen Espeland.
A few years ago, a red-tailed hawk anchored his 11-foot nest near the penthouse of a posh Fifth Avenue apartment building. Birdwatchers dubbed him Pale Male. He found a mate, started a family, and settled in to do what hawks do, dive bomb for dinner and feast on the fresh kills back at the nest. Pale Male's fans loved it. But last December, residents of Pale Male's building grew tired of stepping over the pigeon and rat carcasses he tossed overboard. So, the owners of 927 Fifth Avenue removed his nest. That's when the protests began. The protesters argued that Pale Male belonged to the city and that his nest should not be disturbed. After days of picketing, New York City's Audubon Society and its Parks Department worked out a settlement with the building owners. The protesters celebrated. The nest went back up, and so did Pale Male. A few days later, New Yorker Steve Baldwin said the incident was what brought him out to Central Park to volunteer on a chilly December morning.
What those billionaires did really made me very angry. I thought they were using their power very imperiously to remove an annoyance that was, in fact, a great gift to the people of New York.
Baldwin was one of dozens of volunteers listening for instructions on where to go to tally bird species for Central Park's annual bird count. His neck slung with binoculars. Baldwin said the fact that a red-tailed hawk was thriving on Fifth Avenue revealed a side of the city he'd rarely thought about.
This isn't just a man-made location. This isn't just a world of media and personalities. You know, there's a whole other order of life that's invisible, you know, except when something remarkable like this happens.
Except for celebrity raptors, the only urban wildlife New Yorkers tend to think of is pigeons and rats. But Pale Male signals a bigger trend. What once seemed like a wall between the city and nature is dissolving into a thin, permeable veil. Species the city hasn't seen for decades have been returning. The process actually began in the 1970s. Wildlife veterinarian Scott Newman says one of the first signs of change came when a biologist discovered a nest of egrets.
These birds were actually not just visiting here, but actually nesting here. Over the next 20, 30 years, we've come to learn that in the New York Harbor area, we have thousands of these birds reproducing.
Now, thousands of egrets, herons, and ibis nest on tiny islands that dot the harbor. They don't seem to mind that it's one of the country's busiest. More than 3 million ships cross it every year. But Newman says the harbor is cleaner than it has been in more than 30 years, thanks to anti-pollution legislation. As a result, conditions in the harbor are right for these massive shorebirds.
They need habitat to nest. The second thing after they have the habitat for nests is they need food. Even though we're in a highly urbanized area, 2 miles away from the island of Manhattan, we have the right vegetation for nesting of these species. And in the waters right around Manhattan, we have all the right fish species and invertebrate species to support these birds.
Improving conditions aren't the only explanation for the animals' return. From her office at 103rd Street and 5th Avenue, Sarah Hobel runs a city agency called the Urban Park Rangers. The force educates New Yorkers about city parks and manages park wildlife. Hobel says city habitats are healthier, but animals are being forced into the city as suburbs encroach on their traditional habitats.
When you take into account urban sprawl, the fact that animals are being pushed more and more into and out of settings, they're coming more into an urban setting because urban settings are increasing. So I think that both the improvement in a city like New York of the health of parkland, so when the species finds its way into the setting, it finds food.
Urban sprawl is eating away at critical habitats around the country. A recent National Wildlife Federation study found that sprawl poses the top threat to 85% of the nation's endangered species. But it's also a threat to animals that don't make the endangered list, species that Hobel says are completely alien to New Yorkers.
Well, I got a phone call from somebody quite hysterical saying that there was a vulture sitting in a tree outside the Natural History Museum.
The vulture turned out to be a wild turkey nesting on Manhattan's Upper West Side. The rangers named her Zelda.
I sent a ranger over to find the vulture, and sure enough, it was Zelda. And we didn't know she was Zelda at the time. We just knew she was a turkey. And like I say, I mean, it is unusual to find a single turkey. Turkeys do tend to hang out with each other. And they do like to be in wooded areas. So she is unusual. But she has just loved Manhattan.
In a sense, when Zelda moved to Manhattan, she was coming home. And so was Pale Male. Wild turkeys and hawks were common here 400 years ago when the Lenape Indians called the island Manahatta. Ecologist Eric Sanderson borrows that name for his project to visualize Manhattan as it was, before there'd been any large-scale urban development. Sanderson says that to understand which species might return or be successfully reintroduced, it's important to figure out what once thrived here. To do it, he uses British maps from the 1700s with geographic information software to create a three-dimensional model of the island. On a visit to Wall Street, Sanderson peels away the pavement and the office buildings as he describes what a visitor might have seen in the year 1609.
We would have been in one of these little valleys with low hills, maybe 40 or 50 feet high, looking north from here. The sort of first low hills of Manhattan Island. Well, this probably would have been a great place for birds, all kinds of wetland birds. Would have been a good place for small rodents and small animals like that that would then bring the raptors. So hawks and falcons coming after the other birds would have been here. In terms of mammals, there would have been a ton of deer around here. There were elk on Manhattan that could have come down this far. And out on the shore, there would have been this remarkable fish.
Sanderson hopes Manahatta will provide a roadmap for restoring what the city has lost and protecting what's returned. Those are the jobs that urban park ranger Anthony Prestaro does every day. On a cold, clear Saturday in February, Prestaro led kids from South Brooklyn on a nature walk through their neighborhood's Marine Park. He says the park is a former dumping ground, which the city has slowly been coaxing back to life. Today, tall stalks of feather-topped grasses sway across the marshes, and the waves of Gerritsen Creek slap the frozen shore. The children ran ahead. They found rocks and logs to flip over, scouring the undersides for insects to identify and collect.
Oh, boy, look at them all.
Those are crickets!
Look at all of them.
What are those?
You got sea fleas.
The next half of Prestaro's shift took him to Prospect Park in the heart of Brooklyn. He wanted to check on one of the park's newest arrivals, a great horned owl. He drove his Jeep into the park and checked in with the radio dispatcher.
Show me 8898 Mobile Patrol Prospect Park.
1335.
Prestaro parked near a stand of towering evergreens and scanned the forest floor for the owl's calling card, an owl pellet.
There seems to be a lot of rooting around on the ground in my job. I don't know if I planned it that way or... This is an owl pellet, and what it is, it's a collection of fur and bones that the owls can't chew their food, and they don't rip it too well like a hawk would. So they swallow the small mice and stuff all together in one piece. Is this skull?
Prestaro says that after an owl digests its catch, it regurgitates a palm-sized package of bones and fur. That's the owl pellet. It's not pretty, but it's a sign that this enormous species is finding everything it needs just yards away from the brownstones and subway stops that circle the park. He sets the pellet down and heads back to the Jeep. As he finishes his shift, Prestaro says Prospect Park can attract great horned owls because it's protected and well-funded. But he's worried about an area he used to patrol, a stretch of beach near Jamaica Bay in Queens, where an endangered species of birds called piping plovers have finally begun to reproduce and recover. Prestaro says a new condominium development there could hurt the colony.
These birds didn't ask us to put up, you know, apartments or... We are morally responsible, I feel, for, you know, to take care or to be caretakers or stewards for not only the parks, but the wildlife in them, too. So it's like having a box of donuts and it's like, I'm going to eat them all right now. Like, oh, I'm going to eat all the Boston creams. Now, that isn't fair because I know Joe on the next tour likes Boston creams. You know, we have a, not just to the lands, we have a moral responsibility to, like, generations after us.
Like the Boston creams, opportunities to preserve unprotected habitats in the city are disappearing. In the second of this three-part series, developers and city officials clash over who will be the better steward for a piece of property that could attract even more wildlife to the city. I'm Kristen Espelon, Columbia Radio News.
To hear the rest of Kristen's series, or to hear more pieces like these, drop by the Public Radio Exchange, prx.org. Write your own review to help get more good work on radio. This podcast is produced with support from the Nature Conservancy, committed to saving the last great places on Earth, and is funded by Visa. You can find us online at nature.org/stories. Send us your thoughts and feedback to podcast@tnc.org. From Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Samantha Brown, and I'll be back next week with a new Nature Stories podcast.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.